If you turn in the Word of God tonight to 1 Kings chapter 18, please. We're going to read from verse 1. 1 Kings chapter 18. It came to pass after many days that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, Go show thyself unto Ahab, and I will send rain upon the earth. And Elijah went to show himself unto Ahab, and there was a sore famine in Samaria. And Ahab called Obadiah, which was the governor of his house. Now Obadiah feared the Lord greatly, for it was so when Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Lord, that Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50 in a cave, and fed them with bread and water. And Ahab said unto Obadiah, Go into the land unto all fountains of water and unto all brooks. Peradventure we may find grass to save the horses and mules alive, that we lose not all the beasts. So they divided the land between them to pass throughout it. Ahab went one way by himself, and Obadiah went another way by himself. And as Obadiah was in the way, behold, Elijah met him, and he knew him, and fell on his face, and said, Art thou my lord Elijah? And he answered him, I am. Go and tell thy lord, behold, Elijah is here. And he said, What have I sinned, that thou wouldst deliver thy servant into the hand of Ahab to slay me? As the Lord thy God liveth, there is no nation or kingdom whither my Lord hath not sent to seek thee. And when they said he is not here, he took an oath of the kingdom and nation, that they found thee not. And now thou sayest, Go tell thy Lord, behold, Elijah is here. And it shall come to pass, as soon as I am gone from thee, that the Spirit of the Lord shall carry thee whither I know not. And so when I come and tell Ahab, and he cannot find thee, he shall slay me. But I, thy servant, fear the Lord from my youth. Was it not told, my lord, what I did when Jezebel slew the prophets of the Lord? How I hid 100 men of the Lord's prophets by 50 in a cave, and fed them with bread and water. And now thou sayest, Go tell thy lord, behold, Elijah is here, and he shall slay me. And Elijah said, As the Lord of hosts liveth, before whom I stand, I will surely show myself unto him today. So Obadiah went to meet Ahab, and told him. And Ahab went to meet Elijah. And it came to pass, when Ahab saw Elijah, that Ahab said unto him, Art thou he that troubleth Israel? And he answered, I have not troubled Israel, but thou and thy father's house, in that ye have forsaken the commandments of the Lord, and thou hast followed Balaam. Now therefore send and gather to me all Israel unto Mount Carmel, and the prophets of Baal 450, and the prophets of the grove 400, which eat at Jezebel's table. So Ahab sent unto all the children of Israel, and gathered the prophets together unto Mount Carmel. Amen. We'll end there at verse 20. And we know the Lord will bless the reading of his word to our hearts. This evening we want to consider again why we oppose the papal visit. We want to set down before you some of the other reasons for opposing the visit of the Pope this incoming week. Last Lord's Day evening, we considered the primary grounds of our objection, which are spiritual. The Pope takes titles that belong to God himself and that belong to no one else. The Pope is a blasphemer. And therefore, out of fidelity to God, we protest against the Pope and we oppose his state visit. You see, the Pope is a modern day Ahab. We've read a little here in this chapter about Ahab. We could turn to many other portions of Scripture that talk about his exceeding wickedness, but the Pope is a modern day Ahab. You see, the Pope is an idolater, just like Ahab. Romanism is paganism, just in another guise. Romanism is a present day manifestation of the old Babylonian religion. There's a very good book, I'm sure many of you have it. If you haven't, I certainly would encourage you to pick it up. It's called Hyslop's. It's the Two Babylons. Alexander Hyslop was the author. And in that book, he demonstrates, and I quote, that almost all of the practices of the Roman cult have been brought over from paganism. Whether it's the position of Mary, with emphasis upon the mother and the child, whether it's the veneration of saints or idols, whether it's the Mass, whether it's prayers for the dead, etc., etc., we could go on. They all have their origin in the old worship of paganism, going right back to the days of Babel, the Tower of Babel. The Pope is an idolater. But we can also say tonight the Pope is the troubler of nations. You notice there what was said to him by Elijah in verse 18 in response to what Ahab had said to Elijah, because when he saw Elijah, he said, "Art thou he that troubleth Israel?" And Elijah said to him, "I have not troubled Israel. I'm not the cause of this trouble." And remember, the trouble was the famine that was then in the land, and we get a little insight into just how oppressive it was when Ahab was sending Obadiah to look for water for the king's horses. And Elijah says, "I haven't troubled Israel, but thou and thy father's house, in that ye have forsaken the commandments of the Lord, and thou hast followed Balaam." Well, the Pope is a troubler of nations for the very same reason. They have forsaken, Romanism has forsaken the commandments of God, and they have followed Balaam. It's just a modern form of idolatry. And there is a curse upon any nation that honours the Pope. The Pope, to have the Pope's blessing is to have God's curse. Our forefathers understood that. And that's why tonight we are opposed to the state visit of the Pope. We seek the well-being of our nation. And there will be those that will say that we're troubling Israel. That has already been said by the opponents of those of the opposition that has been raised, that has been raised against the Pope. There have been those who have said, "You ought not to be doing this. You're causing trouble. You're offending people by saying these things." And our answer is exactly what Elijah said to them. It is not us who's the cause of trouble in this nation. It's the Pope and it's Romanism and it's all false religion. Because they've turned away from God and they are bringing down upon this nation and society the chastisement of God. And it will not go well with our nation in honouring the Pope. In receiving him as they will, right from the monarch, right the way down. He's going to be meeting the monarch. He's going to be meeting parliamentarians. He's going to be meeting religious leaders. He's going to be meeting ordinary people. They're even employing the children in honouring him. It is not going to go well with our nation. There will be a consequence to reap. Departure from God brings such upon the nation. Tonight I want to spell out a number of other areas. Four areas that we base our opposition upon. Last time, as I said, we dealt with the spiritual grounds of our opposition. That's the primary grounds of our opposition. But there's a number. It's not the only grounds upon which we oppose the Pope's visit. There are other grounds as well, and I want us to consider these tonight. We oppose the Pope's the papal visit on financial grounds. You see, he comes claiming that he's the head of state, and therefore he is being afforded an official state visit. The last Pope came to the United Kingdom, but he wasn't afforded a state visit. It was only a pastoral visit back then. But this Pope is being given a state visit. He claims to be a head of state, and our own government is going to recognise him in this way. It's one of the old papal claims, as we were noticing last Lord's Day evening, that he is a monarch. In fact, he claims that he rules over every monarch. Every king and queen and president and prime minister, Rome believes, is subject to the Pope. There are old sketches from church history and secular history as well that shows the Pope has foot upon the neck of kings. There are those depictions in history showing the position that Rome claims for herself. She claims to be the ruler of every monarch. And she's been given this state visit for the Pope. Rome is supposedly paying part of the cost for this papal visit. The government would normally pick up the tab for a state visit, and they're doing so with the Pope, and Rome is stepping in and supposedly paying for those purely pastoral aspects of the visit of the Pope. For example, the beautification of Cardinal Henry Newman in Birmingham, the prayer vigil in Hyde Park on the Saturday, and on the Thursday the open air mass at Bellahouston Park. Everything else the taxpayer is paying for. Previously the church had been due to contribute £7 million to the pastoral elements of this tour of the Pope. Now the cost is a considerable sum, and it's ever increasing. At first the cost was reckoned to be in the region of £15 million in total. The taxpayer was going to pay £8 million, the Roman Church was going to pay £7 million. But in the last few months it has been announced that the costs have jumped up considerably. An extra $4 million is estimated now needed to cover the cost of all of these events. And you can guess who's going to have to stump up the extra $4 million. It's not Romanism, it's going to be the hard-pressed taxpayer. I wonder, has it anything to do with the fact that back there in July, Archbishop Nichols, the highest Romanist in the United Kingdom, admitted that Rome has not raised the $7 million that she was supposed to pay towards the cost of the Pope's visit to the United Kingdom. There were £2 million short back in the month of July. And the government's going to step in and cover the cost. The majority of people do not want the Pope to come, and they don't want to pay for his coming. An online survey that was carried out by the public theology think tank called Theos, they found that 75% of Britons think the taxpayer should not contribute to the cost of the Pope's visit. Out of the 2005 adults that were polled, 77% did not agree that the taxpayer should help shoulder the bill for the four-day trip, even though it was a state visit. And we would go along with that majority. We should not have to be called upon to pay for the Pope's visit. Not a blasphemer like the Pope, not one who comes to these shores making the claims that he does. And isn't just typical of Romanism that she would be getting the taxpayer to fund her, lavish as she is with money, and still trying to bleed the people dry, even for the cost of paying for the Pope, selling tickets, I think it's £25 a head, to get into Ballyhooson Park to have that open-air mass. Well, for those reasons, we don't believe that we should be called upon to pay for the papal visit at all. So we oppose it on financial grounds. We oppose it as well on moral grounds. On moral grounds. There is a stain and a stench that has risen in recent years on the character of Romanism over child abuse. It's mentioned in the statement that has been sent out by our presbytery, and that stain and stench reaches right to the Vatican, right up the chain of authority to the Pope himself. I'm not going to thrawl through that awful litany of wickedness tonight. That would, I believe, only be giving you an education in sin. I believe it would be a misuse of the pulpit to do that. But what I want to do is emphasise the unwillingness to deal with what has happened. That's as bad. Bad enough the initial sins and the wickedness. But there has been the cover-up. There has been an unwillingness to deal with these things. You see, let's remind ourselves that Rome is a hierarchical system. The local priest is under the bishop. The bishop is under the archbishop, who in turn is under the Pope. It is the Pope who appoints bishops. It is the Pope who sacks bishops. Nobody else has the power to sack a bishop. Only the Pope. It is his appointment in the first place. Nobody can remove that appointment but him. It is a hierarchical system. And the present Pope has shown a complete unwillingness to deal with these issues. Now, that's not the view of biased Protestants. That's how it would be put over in many circles. That's the view of even Roman Catholics when you listen to them and what they have to say. They believe that the present Pope has not shown a willingness to deal with these things and deal with the perpetrators of these crimes. Many are ashamed. Many Roman Catholics are ashamed of what has been taking place in some of these institutions that bear their name, and have been doing so over many, many years. Let me give you one example, a very recent example of the present Pope's unwillingness to deal with these matters. It's widely reported, but I want to quote to you from a report that appeared in the Catholic Herald on the 12th of August, just a few weeks ago. This is what it says. Pope Benedict XVI has decided not to accept the resignation of two Dublin auxiliary bishops who resigned in the wake of the Murphy Report investigation into clerical child abuse in the Archdiocese. That's the Archdiocese of Dublin. There were two reports. There was the Murphy Report and the Ryan Report. The Murphy Report dealt with the Dublin Archdiocese. The Ryan Report dealt with religious orders and their teaching in schools. So it's talking here about the Murphy Report that dealt with the Dublin Archdiocese. And I go on again to quote, auxiliary bishops Raymond Field and Eamon Walsh resigned on December 24th after coming under intense pressure because they served as bishops during the period investigated by the Murphy Commission. In a letter to priests of the Dublin Archdiocese, Archbishop Dermot Martin confirmed the development. Following the presentation of their resignations to Pope Benedict, it has been decided that Bishop Eamon Walsh and Bishop Raymond Field will remain as auxiliary bishops, he said. Archbishop Martin said the two men are to be assigned revised responsibilities within the diocese. Both bishops initially resisted calls for their resignation. However, both sent resignation letters to Rome after Archbishop Martin apparently failed to give them his total support. So even though the Archbishop of Dublin couldn't fully support them when that report came out, the Pope has refused their resignations. And that's just a sample, and you could multiply incidents after incident tonight where the same type of thing has been involved. A failure to deal with this issue. And it has only created much resentment among Roman Catholics. But we can bring it a little closer to the Pope than that, because there's been allegations against him personally. There's ones coming out of Munich. He was Archbishop of Munich from 1977 to 1981. And there, then he went to Rome. But during his time as Archbishop of Munich, there are allegations coming now to the fore. There, even Newsnight ran an article on it where he was covering up and alleged that he was not dealing with these things. But he, in 1981, he moved to Rome to become the prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, which is one of the most important offices of the Vatican. Very high, prominent position to occupy. And from 1981 right up until he was made Pope, Joseph Ratzinger occupied this position. Now, prior to 2001, the primary responsibility for investigating allegations of abuse and disciplining those perpetrators that were found to have been guilty was left to individual dioceses. That was the policy of Rome up until 2001. But in 2001, Ratzinger convinced Pope John Paul II to put the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, the body that he was in charge of, that he held the highest position in, he persuaded the previous Pope that this body that's called the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, that they be put in charge of investigating all of these matters and placing all of these issues in order to combat more effectively taking place. So for the last 9 years, it has not been the local diocese that has to deal with these matters. It is Rome itself, the Vatican itself. And for a period of time, Ratzinger was the individual in charge of that body that was dealing with it. In other words, you see, he was in the know. Those that report on things and issues in the Vatican say that he was a notorious micromanager. He wanted to know everything that was going on in the Catholic Church worldwide. He wanted every report to go across his desk so that he knew what was going on. Is it logical to conclude that he was unaware of these things? That all of this was taking place and these cover-ups were taking place and he was unaware of these things? I find that hard to believe. And for those reasons, and as I say, we could multiply incidents after incidents on this matter. But for moral reasons, we oppose the papal visit. There will be many who will be protesting, Roman Catholic people protesting against the Pope on these very issues. They're not welcoming him. The survey that they did found that only 75% of Roman Catholics were welcoming his visit. So what about the other 25% of the Roman Catholics? Nobody ever says, well, why are they opposed to his coming? Why do they not want him to come? Because this is the issue that will come up. This will be the issue that will come up. This will be the matter that they will raise and say, this is why we're not supporting his coming to the United Kingdom, because of what he has been involved in and the allegations that are made against him. So we oppose on financial grounds. We oppose his coming on moral grounds. But we also oppose the papal visit on constitutional grounds. You see, the Act of Settlement of 1701 safeguards the British throne from being Catholic ever again. It's a very complicated thing to change, and in that there is a great mercy, because there's been many an attempt in recent times to change it. In fact, and reading up on some of these things for tonight, I'm noticing where the Roman Catholic Church in Scotland has criticised the government, criticised Gordon Brown particularly when he was Prime Minister for his slowness to act on this matter, because they want the Act of Settlement changed. They want it removed entirely. But as I say, it's a very complicated thing, because not only would the British Parliament have to vote to change the Act of Settlement, but every other jurisdiction where the Queen is the head of state. So you take all the countries of the Commonwealth that has the Queen as head of state. Now, not every country in the Commonwealth has her as the head of state. So it's not all the countries in the Commonwealth. But every country that does have her as the head of state, and all of those British dominions, they will all have to vote in their legislature to change the Act of Settlement. So I think it's something like 17 countries would have to vote this through in their parliament in order for it to come into place where the Act of Settlement would be removed. And that, as I say, there's a mercy in that, because there's many's an effort, and the efforts would maybe have been making far greater progress if it just wasn't as difficult to do so. But the Act of Settlement of 1701 safeguards the British throne from ever having a Catholic monarch. It was passed, as I say, in 1701 when the reign of William III, Prince of Orange, was coming to a close. You see, William and Mary didn't have any children of their own, and the successor to William and Mary was going to be Anne. She was going to be queen. But in 1701, she lost her remaining surviving child, which meant that Anne was childless. Therefore, it was going to mean that when Anne came to the throne, whatever length of time her reign would be, when she died, there was no successor who would be Protestant. The throne would revert back to the Stuarts, who were Catholic. So our Protestant forefathers at that time felt it to be expedient that they would bring in a law that only Protestants in communion with the Church of England would be allowed to ascend the throne of England, and then further on the throne of Great Britain. That's why the House of Hanover came to be our monarchs, because in 1714 George I was invited to come and take up the throne. There were others. In fact, there were 57 other people that had a better entitlement to the throne of the United Kingdom than George I of the House of Hanover. But the Act of Settlement excluded all those other 57 people because they were Catholics. And therefore, George I, as he became known, was invited to come, the House of Hanover from Germany, and to take up the British throne in accordance with the wishes that were laid down in the Act of Settlement. Now I want to read just one part of the Act of Settlement. It's Clause 9. And this is what it says, and I quote, "Whereas it has been found by experience that it is inconsistent with the safety and welfare of this Protestant kingdom to be governed by a popish prince or by any king or queen marrying a papist." That's the wording of the Act of Settlement. And as a result of that, you see, there's the reason why the Act of Settlement has been brought in. They said they have found by experience that it is inconsistent with the safety and the welfare of a Protestant kingdom to be governed by a papist. Therefore, they require that anyone ascending to be the monarch of the United Kingdom must be somebody in communion with the Church of England. They must be a Protestant. Now, we wouldn't count the Protestantism of the Church of England very strong, but nevertheless, that's what the Act of Settlement says. You see, our forefathers learned by bitter experience that freedom and liberty is in danger when Romanism is in the ascendancy. That's what the Act of Settlement says. We have found by experience. This wasn't some, blind sectarian idea that lay in some people's hearts. This was what they had learned by experience. This is what they had come through in the years prior to that. They understood that it was essential for the safeguarding of their freedom and their liberty that they bring in this law that is found in the Act of Settlement of 1701. That's what motivated the Act of Settlement. The title of that act really gives a key to it. It says that the act is a declaring the rights and liberties of the subject and settling the succession of the crown. You see, it is emphasizing the rights and the liberties of the subject. It's not so much concerned with the monarch. It's concerned with the rights of the subject. And that's what's trying to be changed by those who clamor for the Act of Settlement to be altered. They want to change the whole emphasis on the Act of Settlement from being something that is emphasising the rights of the citizen, the rights of the individual who lives in this nation. They wanted to emphasise the rights of the individual who assumes to be who ascends to be the monarch. They want the monarch to have the right to be a Roman Catholic. But our forefathers put the emphasis upon the subject, upon you and me, and it's declaring the rights and the liberties of the subject. And that Act of Settlement safeguards our liberty, safeguards this nation as a Protestant nation, at least in name at the minute. It's far away from what it ought to be. It's long forgotten its Protestantism. And that's evident by the welcoming of the Pope. It is forgotten, you see, the bitter experience that our forefathers had to come through. It is forgotten that Romanism is the enemy of liberty and it's the enemy of freedom. And where it is in the ascendancy, it is the citizen who's going to suffer. And because of that history, because of that bitter experience, we oppose the Pope and we say he is not welcome, because this land has learned by bitter experience down through the centuries that it is its liberties and its freedoms is in danger when Romanism is entertained. Rome has a long history of terror in this nation. There are hundreds of martyrs who lost their lives. There are scores of martyr sites, particularly over England, particularly over southern England, places where our Protestant forefathers were put to death. Some of them put to death in the most barbaric fashion. The most barbaric period was during the reign of bloody Queen Mary, 1553 to 1558. Just 5 years, and yet what an awful reign of terror came about during her reign. Because during her time she repaired the relationship with Rome and she returned England to Catholicism. And there were many Protestants who were going to oppose her actions, and did. Many were exiled. Nearly 300 were burned at the stake in different places. That's why she earned her name, Bloody Queen Mary, because of the number of the martyrs that were put to death. Well, tonight we want to stand by the memory of the martyrs. That's why we oppose the Pope's visit. We remember their sacrifice that they made for liberty and for freedom and for the truths of the gospel. That's why we oppose the Pope's visit. And that's why we don't want him to come to this United Kingdom. Because of the heritage that we have. Because of what Rome has done in this nation in times past. And the memory of the reformers and the memory of the martyrs would compel us to resist the papal visit. This is the institution that is going to be honoured this week that put the martyrs to death. That's the institution that is going to be honoured. And when they bring out the cardinals and they bring out the archbishops and the Pope is going to be there and they're all going to be paying homage to them and honouring them and giving them all of these marks of statehood and all the rest of it that is going to be taking place this week, there's not one of them that's going to remember the martyrs. But Rome hasn't changed one iota. She'd still burn the heretic today if she got away with it. She hasn't changed. And we resist the Pope and we resist him coming because of the memory of the martyrs. The memory of the just is blessed, the Bible says. And we remember the martyrs. Our liberties have come down to us because of those who gave their lives. Many of them in the most horrific of conditions. I can't remember where it was. I've been trying to think where it was. We were at some of the martyrs' memorials and holidays, but it tells the story of the men and women who were burned in a circle, and they put a child of one of the martyrs, they put a child in the middle of the fire. Didn't tie the child to a stake or anything, they just put the child in the middle, and there was a ring of fire all round the child, and all of those that were tied to the stake were burned, and the little child was burned in the fire as well. A wicked, hellish system. And therefore we make no apology in resisting the Pope's visit. And we make no apology in saying that he shouldn't be here. And we make no apology in denouncing those that will go to meet him, like the Presbyterian moderator and the clerk of the General Assembly that's going there representing every Presbyterian. We make no apology in calling them to account and saying, if nothing else, if there was no other issue than just the issue on the martyrs, that's good enough grounds to resist the Pope and his people visit this incoming week. Their memory of the martyrs. There's one further grounds upon which we want to notice, and that is we oppose the papal visit on procedural grounds. You see, one of the reasons why the Pope is coming at this time to the United Kingdom is the beautification of John Henry Newman. We mentioned this last week, and I said that we'd possibly make mention of it tonight, and I want to do that very quickly. John Henry Newman originally started out as an evangelical in Oxford. He was a minister of the Church of England in 1816. At the age of 15, he professed faith in Jesus Christ, professed to be converted. He later wrote in his book, Apology, that it was, and I quote, more certain than that I had hands or feet, unquote. He stated that it was in the autumn of 1816 that he thus, and again I quote, fell under the influence of a definite creed. He goes on to say again, and I quote, that he received into his intellect impressions of dogma which through God's mercy have never been effaced or obscured. So that's him talking about that period of time in his life when he was only a 15-year-old boy. And subsequently, he went on to be ordained into the Anglican Church in 1854. He professed to be a Calvinist. He even professed to hold the Pope to be the Antichrist. Over the next 8 years from his ordination in 1824, his views began to change. And they began to move more and more toward High Church Anglicanism. If you know anything about High Church Anglicanism, there's virtually little difference between them and popery. Very little difference. But over a period of time, over those 8 years, John Henry Newman's views began to change. And more he took on the views of English High Churchism, to the extent that he was fervently opposed to nonconformity. Any nonconformists in the university, he opposed their appointment to certain positions. He was fervently against nonconformity. He went on to become a major figure in what was known as the Oxford Movement. That was a drift towards High Church Anglicanism and even on towards Romanism. Tracts for the Times were little publications that came out. In fact, the movement became known sometimes as Tractarianism. And those tracts were published wishing to return the Church of England to a more High Church Anglican outlook, bringing it closer and closer to, in belief and forms of worship, to what was really Romanism. He continued his work for a number of years until in 1841 Tract 90 appeared. That was the last in a series, and it was a detailed examination of the 39 articles, such as the doctrinal basis of the Church of England. And he suggested in that tract that the oppositions that were found in those statements of faith in the 39 articles were not directed against the authorised creed of Roman Catholics, but rather they were directed against popular errors and against exaggerations. So he really made an attack upon the 39 articles of the Church of England. As a result, a few years later, he eventually converted to Roman Catholicism in 1845. He, a little time before that, he put an advertisement into the Oxford Conservative Journal. He did it anonymously, but it was known that it was from him. But it was a formal retraction of all the hard things that he had said against Romanism in his earlier years. So he took back everything that he had said in those early years when he was a professing evangelical. And you can imagine how Rome felt with that. Here was this Anglican priest who had been so fervent against them in a previous time, and now repudiating all that they believed, even attacking the 39 articles of faith, and professing himself now to be a Romanist. And it wasn't too long until they made him a cardinal, a son of the church. So he died as Cardinal John Henry Newman. In 1991, Newman was proclaimed as being venerable. A thorough examination of his life and work took place by the Sacred Congregation for the Causes of Saints. Wonderful body that. But they discovered that one miracle was found to have been performed by this man, and that enabled him to be beautified, and that's going to take place next Sunday. In order for canonization of a saint to take place, there has to be a second miracle that has been reported and authenticated as coming from this man, either dead or alive. He can do it before he died, or something, maybe a relic or somebody praying to him, you know, and got miraculously healed or whatever. They can look for a second miracle, and that means he will be canonized. So they're only beautifying him next Sunday because they've only found one miracle that he has performed. Well, we repudiate that type of nonsense. Our Protestant forefathers repudiated that nonsense of the worship of Romanism. This veneration of saints. God alone is to be venerated. If you turn just to a couple of scriptures, and with this we will conclude what we have to say. Acts chapter 10, Acts of the Apostles chapter 10. It's worth reminding the thinking of the apostles in this matter. Did Peter or John or Paul, did any of them feel they wanted to be venerated? Wanted people to honour them? Well, you've got the example. Just to take one, we could turn to another incident with regard to Paul. But just to take one with Peter, Acts chapter 10, Acts of the Apostles chapter 10. Look at verses 25 and 26 of that chapter. It's Peter in the house of Cornelius. And as Peter was coming in, Cornelius met him and fell down at his feet and worshipped him. But Peter took him up, saying, "Stand up, I myself also am a man." Peter wasn't wanting anyone to venerate him. Peter says, "I'm only a man. You don't venerate me. You don't fall down and do honour to me. I'm only a man." And as I say, we could turn to similar occasion when they, in Iconium, that they tried to worship Paul and Barnabas. And those men likewise resisted that, because this is not of God. This is not New Testament religion. Venerating saints, dead saints at that, not do anybody any good. You see, that's the purpose of beautifying Newman. It is that people will pray to him, and that they will be able to gain benefit by praying, that he'll be able to intercede, and they'll get some of his merit bestowed upon them. That's not what is needed. If you go over just a couple of pages in your Bible, Acts of the Apostles, chapter 13, we were looking at these two verses in the Young People's on Friday night, thinking about God's way of forgiveness or Rome's way of forgiveness. Acts chapter 13, verses 38 and 39. It says, "Be it known unto you therefore, men and brethren, that through this man is preached unto you the forgiveness of sins, and by him all that believe are justified from all things from which he could not be justified by the law of Moses." It's not some dead saint that an individual needs to venerate. It's not John Henry Newman or any other Romish saint that people need. If they want forgiveness of sins, it's Jesus Christ they need. And Paul says, "Be it known unto you, men and brethren, that through this man is preached unto you forgiveness of sins." It's this man. And who is the man that he's speaking of? But you can go back there to the verses previous and you'll discover it's Jesus Christ. That's who Paul is pointing them to. That's what New Testament religion points the sinner to. Jesus Christ. Verse 39 tells you that by faith in him, all who believe are justified from all things. If you have everything that you need in Jesus Christ by way of salvation, why would you go venerating any saint? If Christ meets your need and does it all sufficiently, there is no need to go and venerate any saint or pray to any saint. All that the sinner needs is Christ. And because of the nonsense of popery that's going to be on display this incoming week and next Lord's Day, we oppose the Pope's visit. And we pray that even at this late stage, something will happen that will hinder him coming. Another ash cloud coming over from Iceland would work very nicely. But the Lord is able to move. The Lord is able to bring him down into confusion, if he wills. And if he comes, well then, may the Lord enable us to raise a protest that we do not subscribe to any venerating of the Pope and honouring of him that will take place this week. So I trust that sets out something of why we oppose a Pope's visit. It's important for us all, but I fervently believe it's important for our young people. You young people need to know why we're Protestants. And we need to know why our forefathers stood for what they did, and the fact that many of them died standing for what they did. And we follow on in their train and hope to take the same ground, and if we had an ounce of their courage, the Lord would make us useful indeed. May the Lord bless his word tonight to all of our hearts.